Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. I'm Anne Nicholson.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be honoring the life and career of KUAR, KLRE's radio personality, Anne Nicholson, who passed away in November of 2020.
As the mole says in the first chapter of The Willows in Winter, liking Toad doesn't come into it at all. Toad is. That's the thing about Toad. Just as the trees are, and the river, and summer. Without Toad, there would be nothing much to live for.
An homage to Anne Nicholson on Arts and Letters.
I'm Anne Nicholson. Thank you for joining me. The mole was almost deafened by the blast of wind about him in the wood and blinded by the stinging snow that drove into his face. To make matters worse, the snow was getting deeper all the time, so that it was a struggle getting his galoshes in and out of it, and harder still to make out the path ahead. The trees swayed and creaked about him in the night, and if the wind was not trying to rip his coat off his back, the brambles and branches were, grasping and clutching and scratching him as he struggled on. And it was dark, dreadfully dark.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick.
And I'm radio producer William Wagner.
I'm Arts and Letters story editor and producer Mary Ellen Cubitt. And welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be honoring the life and work of Anne Nicholson, who passed away in November of 2020, and whose 35-year radio show, The Art Scene, broadcast on KLRE and KUAR, recounted, recorded, and chronicled interviews with those involved in the art scene in Little Rock and beyond.
Born in India in what is now Pakistan, Anne was the daughter of a British Army officer. She was educated in India, Kashmir, Scotland, and England. Her storied life brought her to Canada in 1958, and then in 1962 to the United States.
Always interested in the arts, Anne first wanted to become an actress, and then a singer, studying music and receiving a double BA degree in music education and music history from Southern Methodist University in Dallas.
Anne moved to Arkansas in 1978 when her husband, Dr. David Nicholson, was hired at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Anne became public relations director for Ballet Arkansas, helping to produce a regional ballet festival. In 1984, she joined KLRE and conceived, wrote, and narrated a 10-part series of 30-minute programs titled The Forgotten Oscar, based on the stories and poems of Oscar Wilde.
The next year, she began producing and hosting The Art Scene, until her retirement in 2019.
She interviewed the likes of poet Nikki Giovanni.
I didn't honestly know where to start for this interview, except to start at the beginning.
All right.
When did you realize the power of poetry? The weapons in words that you write about in this Acolytes book?
Well, of course, my mother, you know, was a third grade teacher for a great part of her life, and then she became a social worker because teaching just didn't pay enough money. But there's always been poetry. My grandfather was a Latin teacher.
Actor James Earl Jones.
Joe Papp's Shakespeare in the Park was the first significant company I joined.
Literary critic Harold Bloom.
I go back probably to the same generation as yourself in terms of the education that I had. Elocution was major subject when you had to learn by heart.
That is something that I have tried to revive with the best of my students here at Yale.
Best-selling Arkansas author Elin Harris.
Life offers us too many obstacles that in novels that we ought to always have happy endings. And that's something that I think I'll always do.
NPR radio personality Diane Rehm.
When you started the book, while you were writing it, you had some strange dreams.
Oh. You're the first person who's asked me about those dreams.
And cellist Zool Bailey.
I think string players are already kind of accustomed to play on these historic instruments.
Right.
And piano, definitely the piano vibe in a group changes everything, actually.
And throughout each interview, she brought to bear her formidable insight, wit, and breadth of knowledge, helping listeners find their way inside of the books, music, and art being described.
Every holiday season for many years, KUAR and KLRE would broadcast a special episode in which Anne read and discussed from one of her favorite books, The Willows in Winter, by novelist William Horwood, a sequel to Kenneth Graham's 1908, The Wind and the Willows.
Out of the wind, away from the driving snow, he felt his will to go on weakening rapidly. And if it had been any other animal than his dear friend Rat who he felt needed him, he might have taken heed of his nephew's advice and sheltered till daylight in the hope that the blizzard might abate. "I must go on, and I shall," he cried out suddenly, charging out into the blizzard once more and battling on.
This episode will share excerpts from standout moments from her show over the last four decades, and clips from the interview the three of us recorded in her home shortly after her retirement in the fall of 2019.
Anne often said to me that she preferred to be the interviewer rather than the interviewee. Yet in this candid and rare interview with her, we were able to hear from her as she connected the pieces of her life. So, Anne, we're in your lovely house. Would you just tell us some of the things that are in this house? I mean, you have beautiful pictures. And
we got it when we were up. My husband was working in Dayton, and we decided that we were going to take a house in Germany. And in the meantime, he and I went down to Arkansas and looked at the house, which was being emptied because people were moving out of it. And he and I liked it. We went back to Dayton. We'd left our dog there because he was next door to the next door dog and they were all right together. And we decided that we were leaving Dayton. And so we had to take all our furniture with us, including the piano and various other things, and the dog. So we went with the same car and down the same roads to Arkansas. And we bought the house that we liked, and we moved straight into it. So all the furniture we had in Dayton, we ordered in the truck to Arkansas. And we drove down with the dog with us, and we eventually just moved straight into the house with the dog, and we've been here ever since.
This is just such a treasure trove of albums and stereos and pictures,
yeah,
and art. And I know you're always listening to the radio.
Yeah.
Classical music and KUA.
Well, it's pretty nice.
I see all these knickknacks on this table, and you have everything so particular here. These are neat. I mean, it looks like a genie lamp, and you have all kinds of little boxes, keepsakes.
Yeah.
What is that table? It's just beautiful.
Well, it's just a little bit of something. Those are all added up there as well.
Sure. Plates and bowls.
Yeah. They're just fun to have.
To remember. Let me see that picture real quick. This one interests me. Anne.
It's my father.
Right. Would you tell me a little about your dad?
Well,
he's in his picture and he's in his military uniform. He was a very striking man.
And he's an early lieutenant, already old enough to be in an army now. And he'd grown up in Scotland. And when he was it was just the beginning of the First World War. And so he would have been gone up to India in the First World War. And it was the area up there that he would work. And then once that First World War ended, they came back in and he performed in Scotland. So he was after
very, very
that.
Handsome. Very
yeah,
handsome.
Bless his heart. Yeah. And a very gentle man, very bright, brought up in a small town in Scotland where personality and class was very important. And if it hadn't been for the fact that he went to the main school in Glasgow and he made friends with a couple of men who went into being soldiers, and Daddy was going to be in the army. That was the beginning of the First World War. Mm-hmm. And so they all three went off and did their bit. And the two that my father went in with them were surgeons. Daddy was, he was not a surgeon, he was a doctor.
And then this picture, this is of you and your your mother, right?
My mother and her sister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was this taken?
In Japan.
Wow.
My grandfather, they lived in Yorkshire. And my great-grandfather, he was married and they went to Japan because they took their wool to Japan where it began to be woven into marvelous clothes and things like that, mm-hmm. which was what Yorkshire people would take to Japan.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were looking and we thought this was you at first.
No,
this one's your mother, right?
My mother is the little one.
Okay.
So she's probably this one, I think.
Yeah.
And then that one.
Was her sister.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. So they were in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. And then, you know, we know how much you love your dogs.
Yes.
You know, and you talked about your dogs, and this was one, right?
Do you remember Barbara Moody? She was a friend of everybody.
Do you remember Barbara?
Yes.
Yeah.
And she always got me photographs of my dogs.
Yeah.
So I've got several up already somewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's hear again an excerpt from Ann Nicholson's Christmas special.
Help! Cried the terrified mole. Oh my! Oh my! Help! But this final cry was all in vain. It seemed the night turned blacker still, and then deathly silent, the wind gone, the snow no more, as the cold confusion of icy water was suddenly all about him, below, to right, to left, and he was swept off downstream into the night, clutching at a flow of ice. Where the mole had been, nothing was left but the night, the blizzard wind, the river flowing past broken ice, and the first bleak gleams of a winter dawn, shining on a little painted notice on the side of the bank which the mole had so bravely been trying to reach. Rat's House, it said. That is from Chapter 1 of The Willows in Winter by William Horwood. Writing in the 1990s, a sequel to Kenneth Graham's beloved Wind in the Willows. As he describes it, something at the end of The Wind in the Willows has always worried him. The idea that, as Graham put it, he was indeed an altered toad. Toad altered, says Horwood. I didn't believe it then, and I don't believe it now. Toad always seemed to me incorrigibly unaltered, and what I wanted to know was, what happened to him next?
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to our conversation with radio personality Ann Nicholson.
So, to tell us just about your early life. When you were a little girl, you were in India. How did your father decide to go to India?
Well, he was in the British Army. The war broke out while he was out there, and war took place for 5 years. And we all were in India together. And then he had to go back to battle. And we were sent up to Kashmir to get out of trouble. And my father was a doctor in the army, and he was caught to tow down to Pune, which was a fairly busy town in India. And he was told to help put together a boat, a ship. And they were going to go to Singapore and fight for the British there. On the way in, they heard that the waters there were already attacked by the Japanese. So they moved the ship and they went toward Burma. And as they went to Burma, the same boat, same ship, into the beginning of the big river in Burma, when they heard the news that the Japanese were in the town. So they turned around in safety and went back to Calcutta. And so the British Army fought the British War all the way through from there to the final battles when the war was over.
What was it like growing up in India?
We lived in India. We all had books and we all read, lots of reading. And we managed to do this and go to church and do things like that. And when we had to move up to Kashmir, the whole family picked up and moved. My father kept in the army, was in the south, and my mother and the governess we had and the three of us moved up. I was the oldest, and my sister Joanne was the next, and Jennifer was the baby. And when we went up to Kashmir during the war, because that was the way that we were all sent to Kashmir as being safer, and we went to boarding school up there. And when we were in Kashmir, there was Srinagar, which was cars and things like that. And then there was Gulmarg, which was all horses. The one that I liked particularly, and we had it for me, was a very ugly horse. And if I could ride him, I could get him to run and to jump. And so we'd do things like that. And that was fun.
After you were in India, where did you go?
Well, after we left India, that was the end of the war. And so everybody who could went back to England. And it became very difficult because we didn't know where to go. There were no schools. And finally, we went to a Wigmore school. And we all went to the same school and learned all the same things we were supposed to learn. And then I was not very bright because I had been old enough that a lot of those subjects, like mathematics and chemistry and all these other things, were already being taught, and I had not even heard of them. And I remember the mathematics teacher coming in, a very tall, slim girl who had been in the army all the while until it was over. And she came in to teach a couple of things that left me absolutely lost. And I hadn't a clue what to do in various subjects, mathematics particularly. So I did what I could. And most of the time when I was in school in that particular area, we had some good teachers, and it was a beautiful building, lovely old, old college, and we all were taught these things, but they couldn't really get to much of mine because all I did was read.
Let's listen as Ann Nicholson reads from Oscar Wilde's 1887 story, The Sphinx Without a Secret.
I begged Madame de Rastai to tell me about her, but all that I could learn was that she was a widow with a beautiful house in Park Lane. And as some scientific bore began a dissertation on widows as exemplifying the survival of the matrimonially fittest, I left and went home.
I'd go to the library and get a book, and I'd just read poetry and romance and all those other things and love it. Nobody knew what I was doing.
The next day, I arrived at Park Lane, punctual to the moment, but was told by the butler that Lady Alroy had just gone out.
You didn't like math so much, but you loved to sing?
I never succeeded in mathematics. Yeah. So when I left school, I could only pass reading and writing, and arithmetic, I suppose, but mostly it was acting, and I made no time at all before I was on the stage, and we would have great fun.
How did your mother and father feel about you as a burgeoning performer?
Well, Daddy didn't do much because he was working still, and he was up in Scotland. And then he and my mother went to Singapore, and they took Jennifer, the baby, in with them. And so she was sort of swimming and learning how to ride a horse in Singapore. And then she came home again at about 6 or 7 and go to school. So she had to go to school too. So when I left school, I applied to get into one of the teaching schools in London. And I managed to get into one of them and stayed there for a year. When I met Joseph Hislop, who was a Scots singer who had had a noble career as a singing tenor when he and his wife lived in Stockholm. And he went to many countries and got a good reputation as a very fine tenor for the opera. And he really did very well. And he was teaching by the time I met him, when he joined a house in London and began teaching. And I was curious and inquisitive and asked him, and he gave me to learn lessons to his wife, who had been a very well-known singer. And it all went together, and that was how it all started.
When did you meet your husband to be?
David, he was very practical. And we met and just talked, and he was easy to talk to. And he came up to Scotland to meet my family, and we had agreed that we would get together. Didn't take very long. And there was a Christmas ball at the small town in Scotland. And I had a lovely dress that I just bought. And they had a ball. And we all danced at the ball. And I had an engagement ring. And the next day, we went round to see my family. And David and I told my parents that we were going to get married.
What did your parents think?
They didn't say anything. Nothing much they could do. I think that wedding dress is still upstairs. It was 1955, and we got married and lived in London for a short while in a flat. David had a practice in medicine, and he was able to earn quite a lot. Lived in London. And we had our first baby in London. We got, as I said, Neil in the same hospital where he was working. And I remember that I was busy getting the baby. And he came in to say goodbye. He was off to have a party. And he left. And the next morning, he came in to say hello with a big grin on his face, because he had a baby boy. And so he was a very good-looking baby and very well brought up. And that's when things began to get a little bit sort of tricky, and we decided that we would emigrate.
That you would emigrate?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go first?
We went to Canada, because it was way out, because it was a big number of doctors who were all in the same category of doctors who got the ability to teach people in that whole part of Canada where we lived for a short while.
Let's hear again an excerpt from Ann Nicholson's Christmas special, in which she reads from and talks about The Willows in Winter by novelist William Horwood.
Come on, Otter, we must make for Moland as fast as we can, because that's where Portly was going to. Mole will have some news for us, I'm sure. At Moland, they find Portly, who tells them what has happened, and how Mole's nephew left later to search for his uncle. So, leaving Portly to keep the fire burning and the house warm, with a candle in the window to light the way back, the Water Rat and the Otter set off to trace Mole's path.
We're listening to KUAR KLRE radio personality Ann Nicholson talk about her life and storied career on Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with radio personality Ann Nicholson as she talks about her life and career at KUAR.
You know, I'm just looking at your biography, and it says that you got a double BA degree in music education and music history from SMU in Dallas.
Mm-hmm. It was the big town in there.
Sure.
And that's where I ended up getting my own degrees. So my degrees are from Dallas.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in music history, too.
Mm-hmm. And it was all nice, interesting to do, you know, and the music. And I was in the choir and enjoying the music and doing the things that I could do.
So tell us about your early work here. Because you told me stories about how when you came here, you worked for the Little Rock School District and that you began a series of shows on the radio. The first, I think, was on Oscar Wilde.
The Forgotten Oscar is underwritten by a grant from the Arkansas Arts Council and the National Endowment for the Arts in cooperation with KLRE-FM. Here is narrator Ann Nicholson with today's program.
We continue the series, The Forgotten Oscar, featuring some of the short stories and poems of Oscar Wilde. Today, we conclude the story of The Star Child. The first part told how a baby was found in the forest one bitter winter night, just after a shooting star fell from the sky. Believing he was a special child, the boy, reared by poor foresters, grew up conceited and cruel. And because he was unusually beautiful, all the other children followed his example. Until one day a beggar woman, whom they had mocked and tried to drive away, turned out to be his mother. But the star child stirred not from his place, but shut the doors of his heart against her.
I can remember the buildings that we used. I'm trying to remember.
That would have been the Votek building, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, it was KLRE.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I know William's here, and he's helped you so much.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout the years.
From the way back. We've had the same sort of footsteps, haven't we?
My main duty was to help you with the non-classical pieces of music, and that's where I first heard Anne's, the program that she was doing at the time before Art Scene. It was a literary program. She and Avis Moore, I think, did an hour, Anne did a half hour, and then Avis Moore did the other half of the hour.
And he used to help me by talking behind me when I was describing what we were going, what I had put into the tape for some of those shows we had.
Well, I do remember Eddie Zott taught you how to splice tape and how to put it all together with, just a razor blade and some splicing tape.
The razor, you know, to cut the tape and join it together again. What a mess.
Arkansas Ballet started here. After you and David had moved here, you were involved in kind of helping get that going, correct?
Well, that's what I joined because I'd been joining friends on ballet companies in other areas. And this time they were calling themselves the Ballet Arkansas. And so we all joined it and became part of it. And so we would just be around pulling strings and making sure that people would come when people were interesting. And then the companies that came in from other parts of the state, maybe later into some of the ones around here, that they came in and it went very well. And I remember we were living in this part of town and going out to eat wherever we had breakfast or something, that we'd go out with the people who were working for the party the next day and things like that. Because it was all very much close together and worked together.
Do you remember the tradition of when they started partnering with the symphony to do the Nutcracker?
Yes, it was part of it. But it wasn't a full atmosphere. because the places to put the musicians was only big enough for a few people to play in the same area. But they did have enough to perform with. And it did grow a little bit. Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. I'm Anne Nicholson. This week is very special for me. My guest is Michael Fine, whose name is exceptional in music. He wins just about everything he touches. He is one of the first to be asked to record the works of others.
Can you just remember maybe how you got the idea for doing the Art Scene, the show?
I just know that I know what I want to do, mm-hmm. and I knew where I wanted to go, and I knew what and how to do it.
You know, we know you've interviewed some really pretty prominent people, James Earl Jones.
And you obviously respond to words, as so many of us do, instinctively, and know how to use them yourself.
I don't know. I'm always trying. For me, speech is a developing process. I was a stutterer as a child, and I did not use speech at all. So, but I always, while mute, I gained a great appreciation for those who could express themselves.
How did you overcome the stuttering?
I'm still working on it.
Really? No one would know.
That's good.
You interviewed him. Hillary Clinton.
How did you find, when you went into it, the comparisons with those school districts and the school districts that did not have an active arts and ed program?
Well, one of the conclusions we drew in our work about the existing curriculum in all of our school districts was that the more a curriculum included art and music, included a broader offering in the humanities, included foreign language, the better educational offering the children in that district would have. And that was demonstrated by such statistics as the number who went on to higher education, the kinds of scores that were exhibited on standardized tests. But even more than that, and although you couldn't quantify it, the kind of feeling one got from walking the halls of different schools. And since that time, I have been extremely gratified to see the changes in attitude in many of our school districts with the introduction of art courses, with the introduction of foreign language courses, with the use of satellite television, which brings all kinds of opportunities into the classroom, no matter how rural the setting might be. So I have a direct feeling in my own observation that what we've done by requiring more arts and humanities offering has not only increased the learning that goes on, but it's increased the whole quality of the educational experience for those who are teaching, for parents, for the larger community in many of our districts.
So you interviewed politicians, you interviewed authors, poets,
mm-hmm.
Joe McDougall and Nikki Giovanni.
Stories have been a part of my upbringing, and I'm a Knoxvillian by birth. I was born in Knoxville, Tennessee, and of course Knoxville is in the heart of Appalachia, and the Appalachians are great storytellers. We always laugh because probably our most famous storyteller in Appalachia is Dolly Parton, and she tells stories in songs. So there's a tradition there of storytelling, and poetry is really just, and not really just, but poetry is storytelling. There has to be a reason. There's something that poetry is conveying. Mostly, I think poetry conveys emotional information, but nonetheless, it is conveying.
Yes, but you have, there's some delightful poems. You'll hear all sorts of books and papers going because I'm keep going back to my notes.
Uh-huh.
Some of them are ones you wrote: The Death of Innocence,
yes.
The Storyteller's Silence.
Oh yes. Uh-huh.
The writings when you'd obviously been caught by the drama of the assassinations in 68,
yes.
The disturbance to the country's awareness of itself, what it was, who it was, where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Dancing Snowflakes.
Yeah.
When Rainbows Laugh. And, I mean, as I said, those are the titles that I catch and I look at and I read the poem. And I can't believe how enchanting they are.
This is pretty amazing.
We were very excited when you interviewed Harold Bloom. I don't know if you remember that conversation. That was a phone conversation. Yeah. He talked to you, seemed very taken with you.
Yeah, I did it when he was on the other end of the line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting back to some of your aspects of how to read and the use of irony.
In the simplest and broadest sense, which is when the poet or someone in a story or a novel, or most of all perhaps on the Shakespearean stage, says one thing but rather clearly means another, sometimes indeed the very opposite by implication. To lose that sense of irony is, I think, to lose the capacity to read great and serious literature. And of course, I speak about the recovery of irony as one of the major principles of reading because I think we are in great danger of losing it now.
NPR's Diane Rehm.
While you were writing it, you had some strange dreams.
Oh, you're the first person who's asked me about those dreams.
How many did you have? You just mentioned two, I think.
Oh, I had dream after dream after dream, but I wasn't going to write a book on dreams. But yeah. It was so, that first one was so. So frightening.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing I like, Anne, is the encyclopedia that you have in your head with all the classical music. And, you know, in the studios, we have a whole series of classical CDs. And remember the list we have that you'd always say, hey, William, put in this one.
Zewell Bailey first came to Arkansas in 1991, a young cellist who had just won the National Federation of Music Clubs Young Artist Award in strings, which, apart from a cash prize, gave him 2 years of recitals nationwide, arranged by the NFMC and affiliate music clubs. The Little Rock Musical Coterie was one of the Arkansas Federation of Music Clubs who sponsored a short tour of the state, and we were all impressed by Zewell's enthusiasm and already outstanding musicianship.
So tell us about Zewell Bailey.
Oh, Zewell Bailey is just an amazing, amazing player. And he came the first time we ever saw him. He was a kid, and he was just working up the ladder. Zewell is a love. He just is. He's absolutely amazing. I imagine it must be fascinating, too, Zewell, for the exploration of different types of music that you wouldn't necessarily have considered in some of these other places where you work.
Absolutely. And again, it is balance and variety that kind of gives perspective when playing a Dvorak concerto or a Bach cello suite or hearing indigenous music to one of these villages here in Alaska or elsewhere. I mean, you start to find the common threads in all of it, and it helps just perspective and humanity.
And he knows what he's doing, and he knows his instrument. He holds his cello as is something he praises. It's something he loves, and it's his toy, as in his love and his whole thing. So when he plays that instrument, it's part of his body. It really is amazing to see and to hear him. And we did a wonderful story with him on one of his even latest programs, how he and the music and the women who were prisoners. How on earth did it come about that you have become involved with an extraordinary organization such as this one?
Because of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, I've been frequenting Alaska more as a performer and as a presence to try to make a difference. And this organization that created the prison music program is in its ninth year. It's been evolving slowly ever since and gaining more and more support. They asked me a year and a half ago if I would come in and be their guest artist and perform with the inmates as well as for them, as well as as a part of their ensemble. And because of my mission in general, of course, I said yes.
And it's so exciting, so exciting.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, radio is kind of making a resurgence. People really are enjoying radio, particularly podcasts. And your, you know, show, where we put at least 30 of your best shows on the internet. I'm just wondering if it was a young person who came to you and said, Anne, how can I learn to do this? Well,
I was just thinking that while just this last year that I've been doing the ones with Danny, and apparently he and I have done a little bit of some of the things I've done in the past, that he, bless his heart, has picked up and gone into history.
From UA Little Rock Public Radio, this is The Art Scene. I'm Daniel Breen. It's been over 70 years since we were first introduced to the story of George Bailey and his guardian angel Clarence. Frank Capra's 1946 masterpiece, It's a Wonderful Life, has become a Christmas staple.
You know, one thing you told me, Anne, which was really a nice bit of advice, and that was early on when I was asking you how to do interviews well, you would always say, you know, Brad, usually it takes them a little while to get going.
Mm.
And I used to cut off the beginning and kind of start in the middle, that was the good stuff.
Mm.
But you always told me that. You said, you know, usually the first 20 minutes, not so good.
Mm.
But then they start talking.
And,
you know, so that was really good advice, I thought, for me. Here's Arkansas writer Elin Harris talking with Anne Nicholson about poet and Arkansas native Maya Angelou.
You quote an incident where you had talked to Maya Angelou and expressed your hidden, burning desire to write or to be a writer.
Absolutely. When I read her book when I was maybe in the ninth grade, I was just so impressed by the language and the fact that someone, of course, I related to the Arkansas part, could come from Arkansas and achieve, you know, such wonderful honors and what have you. And I always loved that book. I loved Baldwin and Richard Wright. When I was coming into town this week, we passed the Little Rock Public Library, and when I was growing up, that was my spot. I would go on Saturday, and I would stay all day. And it was the first time that I began to dream about leaving Little Rock, that there were other places beside where I lived. And I thought then, what power, you know, the written word has to transform you, because when I would be reading other books, I wouldn't be in Little Rock anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was something unattainable.
Because you come on quite a bit these nights.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Well, you know, you were an inspiration, and you, like I said, you interviewed us very early in our first season, and you were really an inspiration to me just to watch you do your interviews, because you do such nice things. You talk about the work, you talk about timely things, but you also put yourself in there just a little bit, not a lot, but a little, to get them talking to you. So you'll say, you know, I was a singer. You know, I saw this. Poet Nikki Giovanni.
You sound a little bit almost like a soulmate, if I may make so bold as to say so. I've got part of my yard branched, sort of fenced off, not fenced off completely, but separate from the main bit, that I have now, through the National Wildlife Federation, been admitted into the ranks of those who have national, what do they call it, urban wildlife backyard habitats. Mm-hmm. Like you, I watch the birds and look at I've been told there will be snakes, because snakes will come, but they're good snakes. A garden needs snakes.
The acreage next door to me is just about one, maybe 1.25 acre. I did that. And my dog and I are on this side of our yard, which is about just about an acre. Yeah, actually, I'm having about 2 acres here. I'm not rich. I wish I were. I'd have more. But I did that, and I took the what we call the meadow now. I took it back to Virginia grasses. We have, you mentioned snakes. See, we have mice out there. And it's too far over. The mice are not going to come into the house. Plus, I have a dog, so the mice are not interested in coming to the house. But you do get a, you pick up your black snakes. Of course, your little garden snakes, you just need them, period. You know, you don't have a problem with that. And there's a little pond out there.
Well, and I've got to tell you that we're so proud of you, all of us here. I, in particular, admire just how you've done such good work with the art scene. But beyond that, just how you've persevered and you've fought and you're strong-willed, but you also are so giving and kind to all of the artists and folks that have been on your show and other people. And William in particular has pictures that you have brought him back from England. You brought big posters back of rock bands.
Oh,
for him.
Yeah. What was that big one you like so much?
Oh, the David Bowie.
Yeah.
David Bowie.
Yeah.
And The Who. And then just for me, you've just been such an inspiration coming into the studio and working so hard. So we're very proud of you.
Well, I don't like the idea of not being able to do some of the things that I still feel that I can do something and make it so that something can be done for me and others to work into it, because
sure,
it is such fun.
The otter sniffed, and a great big tear rolled down his face in the dusk. The three returned to Mole End, hoping in vain the mole will find his way home. The next morning, Ratty slips out early, and his friends come upon him sitting by the river.
"What's he doing?" asked Portly.
The otter stared dumbfounded, signaling to the others to be very quiet.
"I've only seen him doing this once before, and it is a rare privilege for us to be witness to it," whispered the otter. "This is something you'll be able to tell your children and your grandchildren. You saw, Water Rat is communing with the river. She's talking to him, and he is talking to her, and I have no doubt at all that it is about Mole they are speaking. Now, however long it takes, we shall stay here very quietly, so as not to disturb either of them."
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org.
Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program.
Thank you to Jeffrey Robson for collecting the music that we were able to use in this show.
Thank you to KLRE, KUAR, and The Art Scene for the archived interviews.
Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for helping us to mix and master the program.
Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas.
Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Thank you to Ann Nicholson, the Grand Dame of Interviews,
for giving us proof of her passion, The Art Scene, for 35 years. We'll miss you very much.
For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed these words from Ann Nicholson.
And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.